The theme of Psalm 120 is that it is a prayer and a journey of someone who's something of an outsider. Now, one of the things that makes this psalm special is Psalm 120 is the first of a series of 15 psalms. So here from Psalm 120 all the way through Psalm 134, each one of these psalms is going to have the title, A Song of Ascents. And the reason for this collection and this arrangement is not precisely said to us. There are many different explanations that have been given for these songs of degrees or steps or ascents. Some people have translated this idea, the stairs of the temple songs, the step songs, the gradual songs, the progression songs, the progression or procession from Babylon songs. And some people have known them as the Pilgrim Festival songs. James Montgomery Boyce, in his commentary, explains the first suggestion as it being something of the temple step songs. He says, quote, the Talmud says that the 15 songs correspond to the 15 steps between the courtyards of the temple and the temple itself. Some have even suggested that the songs were sung by the Levites from these steps, though this is pure speculation. Again, that's James Montgomery Boyce. Probably the best explanation for this collection that we know as the Songs of Ascents is the last one that I listed to you, the Pilgrim Festival songs, that these were songs for the people of God as they made the pilgrimage journey to Jerusalem and to the temple at the three appointed feasts of Israel, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. At those three feasts, Israel was commanded to gather at the tabernacle or temple, all of those who were able to, who lived in a distance, could actually do it. So there were hundreds, if not thousands, of Jewish people coming from all over the region into Jerusalem. They would travel together in groups. And the thought is that they would sing these songs together as they journeyed to Jerusalem. Now, they are called the Songs of Ascents because Jerusalem is a city at somewhat of a high elevation. And so both geographically and in spiritual concept, you go up to Jerusalem, you ascend to Jerusalem. Therefore, these pilgrim songs are thought of as being the songs of ascents. Now, 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 6 uses this phrase, this idea of ascents, to describe the bringing of the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. We read there, to bring up from there the Ark of the Lord. And according to Charles Spurgeon, and a few others as well, the word we translate ascents shares the same root with to bring up in 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 6, and the same root word is used in the same context also in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 15. And so the idea is, again, of coming up, rising up, ascending. It's something important for us to consider that these songs very well have been sung by pilgrims, by those coming unto the Lord to meet him at Jerusalem for many centuries. If I could give you an extended quote here, it begins like this. He says, we shall consider them, this is from Adam Clark, we shall consider them as songs sung by those pilgrims who went up to Jerusalem to worship. These songs of desire and hope and approach are appropriate for the pilgrim as they go up to worship. That was G. Campbell Morgan. I'm sorry. I'll read you a quote from Adam Clark in just a moment. Again, songs sung by pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem. Now, this being likely so, it really does seem to be the best explanation for this idea of the songs of ascents. Then Jesus would have sung these songs on his many journeys to Jerusalem from Galilee. That's something to keep in mind, both as a boy and as a grown man. Jesus would have made that pilgrimage many, many times and sung these songs of ascents. Now, for the quote I spoke to you about from Adam Clark, he says this, quote, "The author of these 15 Psalms is not known, and most probably they were not the work of one person. They have been attributed to David, to Solomon, to Ezra, to Haggai, to Zechariah, to Malachi, without any positive evidence. They are, however," Adam Clark speaking again, "excellent in their kind and written with much elegance, containing strong and nervous sentiments of most exalted piety, expressed with great felicity of language in a few words." Well, Adam Clark thought a lot of these songs of ascents. I think you will think a lot of these songs of ascents as we walk by them, walk through them, I should say, verse by verse. So let's begin now with Psalm 120. I'm going to read to you verses 1 and 2, and we're going to see this first of the 15 of the songs of ascents. Here we go. "In my distress, I cried to the Lord, and he heard me. Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue." Notice, he begins here in verse 1. "In my distress, I cried to the Lord." You know, the people of God often find themselves in distress. Now, they have a refuge in their distress. They can do what the psalmist did when he cried to the Lord. We can also share in the singer's testimony by saying, "He heard me." Notice, distress is something that often makes us cry to the Lord. I like what the old Puritan commentator John Trapp said about this. He said, "Distress adds wings to our devotions. Our Savior, being in agony, prayed more earnestly," in Luke chapter 22. "So do all his people, and especially when they lie under the lash of a lying tongue, as here." Again, that was the old Puritan commentator John Trapp. So he cried to the Lord in the midst of his distress, because in some sense that was the only refuge he had. When we are slandered and lied against, as the psalmist was here, we often find little comfort from other people. It usually does no good to ask the slanderers to stop. They don't care about stopping. Often, our only real source of comfort is the Lord. So the psalmist made complete sense when he just said, "I cried to the Lord." And then the wonderful answer, did you see it there? "And he heard me." Again, that's in verse 1. The psalmist remembered that God had heard him in the past, and he realized that God would hear him in the present. We can take that as solid grounds. What God has done once before, he may do again. And that seems to be the idea of the psalmist here. It is true, to quote Charles Spurgeon, "When we are slandered, it is a joy that the Lord knows us and cannot be made to doubt our uprightness. He will not hear the lie against us, but he will hear our prayer against the lie." And that's why he prays here in verse 2, "Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips." The psalmist here described the nature of his distress. What troubled him so greatly were evil words spoken against him from lying lips and a deceitful tongue. Now, there's some comfort in his cry unto the Lord, knowing that the evil spoken against the singer was not true. It came from lying lips. Listen, if people are going to say anything bad about me, I hope that they're lying. I hope that they're not speaking the truth. And that was the case with the psalmist here. What was spoken evil against him was spoken with lying lips and with a deceitful tongue. The lies that our soul needs deliverance from are not only the lies said about us. We also need deliverance from the lies that are said to us. Lies about God, lies about mankind and ourselves, lies about life, lies about identity, lies about purpose, lies about happiness. From these, we cry out to God, "Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips." Please consider that, dear brother or sister. You need deliverance not only from lies said about you, but from lies that are said and sold to you. Now, in verses 3 and 4, he's going to think about the destiny of the deceitful tongue that is speaking against him. He says this, again, verses 3 and 4. What shall be given to you? Or what shall be done to you, you false tongue? Sharp arrows of the warrior with coals from the broom tree. So the psalmist shifts here from praying to God, that's in the first two verses. Now he's speaking to the false tongue, to those who caused him such distress. He's warning those lying lips of their destiny. He's telling them, what shall be done to you, as it says there in verse 3. You see, in light of the judgment that's described here in verses 3 and 4, it's worth remembering that a false tongue is said to be like a sharp razor. That's in Psalm 52, verses 2 and 4. It's also said to be like a sharp sword. That's in Psalm 57, verse 4. And a lying or a false tongue is also said to be like sharp arrows. That's in Proverbs 26, verses 18 and 19. Well, what can these wicked liars expect? They can expect to receive, look at verse 4, the sharp arrows of the warrior. The false tongue of the singer's enemies would soon know the sharp arrows of the warrior. They had cast out lies like dangerous missiles, and now the sharp arrows of judgment would come against them. Adam Clark suggested that the picture here is of flaming arrows or fiery darts, as Paul would use much later in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 16. Clark said, fiery arrows or arrows wrapped about with inflamed combustibles were formerly used in sieges to set the palaces or the places on fire. Well, maybe that's the sense. But sharp arrows are bad enough whether or not they're on fire or not. But you see, Derek Kidner observed this, that the liar, wounding though his weapons are, will be destroyed with far more potent arrows than lies. God's arrows are full of truth and coals of judgment. That's what the psalmist could confidently expect God would bring against. So this really gives us some perspective, doesn't it? When people are lying about us, when people are lying against us, it can sometimes drive us to distraction and desperation. How can we stop them? What can we do? And there may be a time and a place for us to defend ourselves, though often much rarely than we think. But nevertheless, I want you to know this. The ultimate answer to the lies that people say against us, I'm not saying it's the only answer, but the ultimate answer is that God will judge those people who lie against us, who do to us what was being done to the psalmist, to those of us who need deliverance from lying lips and a deceitful tongue, as the psalmist stated it in verse 2. Let's take a look now at verses 5 and 6, where he speaks about sort of the trouble and weariness that he has to live with. Again, verses 5 and 6, he says this, woe is me that I dwell in Meshech, that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. My soul has dwelt too long with one who hates peace. We sense a weariness from the psalmist in these two verses, as he cries out in verse 5, woe to me that I dwell in Meshech. Meshech was a distant place, far from the land of Israel. You can find reference to it in Ezekiel chapter 27 and Ezekiel chapter 32 and Ezekiel chapter 39. Kedar was a place associated with the nomadic tribes that lived in the land surrounding Israel. You can find reference to that in Isaiah chapter 21 and Jeremiah chapter 49. I like what James Montgomery Boyce had to say about these two places, Meshech and Kedar. He said, these two peoples were located so far apart geographically that they can only be taken here as a general term for the heathen. No one person could have lived among both. They are example of warlike tribes among whom the singers of Psalm 120 had no true home. Now, Willem van Gemeren points out that in verse 5, there are actually two different Hebrew words, both translated by the Hebrew word dwell, at least in the New King James Version. The first word dwell in the original Hebrew has the sense of sojourn, and the second word has the sense of tabernacle. Even though the psalmist may have enjoyed a permanent residence, according again to Willem van Gemeren, he felt as if he was no more than a sojourner among his contemporaries. He did not feel at home among an ungodly people. And that's why he says, again, woe to me that I dwell in Meshech, that I dwell among the tents of Kedar. Again, he's probably not speaking literally because those two places were very far apart among heathen peoples. But he's saying, I feel that I live distant, separated among the heathen. He's using poetry to express the way that he feels. Then he says in verse 6, my soul has dwelt too long with one who hates peace. The psalmist ached because he lived among the ungodly and he was distant from Israel and its people. He longed for God's peace, for God's shalom. Now, his enemies, the ones who had lying lips mentioned in verse 2, they hated God's shalom. My soul has dwelt too long with one who hates peace. And if you are troubled, if you are discontent living among people who hate God's shalom, his peace, I would say that's a good discontentment. Contentment among liars, slanderers, and those who hate God's peace, it's not good to be content among those people. John Trapp, again, that Puritan commentator who speaks in a very strong, old-fashioned way, he says this, the very society of such, be they ever so tame and civil, is tedious and unsavory to a good soul, like the slime and filth that is congealed when many toads and other vermin join together. John Trapp's speaking very vividly, but again, he's giving us a sense of the evil, the wickedness among those people who love lies, who love slander, and who hate God's peace, his shalom. Now, this makes Psalm 120 a very fitting start to the Songs of Ascents. As the pilgrim journey to Jerusalem began, the author was mindful of the weariness that he endures living apart from the supportive community of God's people. The psalmist needed this trip to Jerusalem at feast time, and he needed the larger community of the people of God. Now, in verse 7, the last verse of Psalm 120, we're going to see the contrast between the singer and the community where he lives. He says this strongly, starkly, verse 7. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. The psalmist loved and longed for God's peace, his shalom. He says, I am for peace. That's very interesting. Several commentators mention this, as well as Willem van Gemeren. He says that phrase, I am for peace, it really translates a more literal phrase that would just say, I peace. In other words, in his entire being, the psalmist longs for the establishment of peace, of God's shalom. So that's his heart. He's for peace in every regard, in every aspect. But, verse 7, when I speak, they are for war. The psalmist sought to speak words of peace and goodness, God's shalom. He wanted to represent and promote those values in his own community, yet every time he did, the response was hostile. It was characteristic of those who are for war. At least for a while, the singer of this psalm needed some better company. He needed to get around, or he needed to get away from, I should say, those people who are for war, who hate God, shalom, and he needed to get around some better company. He was going to find that better company among the pilgrims who would join him on the road to Jerusalem and who would share the songs of ascents with him and sing these songs of ascents with him. I like what Alexander McLaren says, kind of as a closing thought to this psalm. Alexander McLaren said this, "So the psalm ends with a long-drawn sigh. It inverts the usual order of similar psalms in which the description of need is wont to precede the prayer for deliverance. It thus sets forth most pathetically the sense of discordance between a man and his environment, which urges the soul to feel that it must seek a better home. So this is a true pilgrim psalm." Are you ready? Are you ready to begin a journey, this song of ascents? It begins with being somewhat dissatisfied with where you're at right now and knowing that you need some better company. Now, before we conclude, let's consider a few ways that Psalm 120 points to Jesus. We love to see Jesus throughout the Old Testament, throughout the Bible, and in Psalms especially. So let's think of a few ways that Psalm 120 might point to Jesus. First of all, Jesus is the ultimate one who was lied against. If there was anyone who could pray the prayer of verse 2, it was Jesus. Listen to this again. "Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue." Jesus was lied against and slandered and deliberately misunderstood again and again and again. He would be the ultimate one to pray, "Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue," just as we read in verse 2. I've got good news. God the Father answered that prayer, and truly he delivered the soul of Jesus from those lying lips and deceitful tongues. Secondly, in verse 5, the psalmist complained that he sojourned among the ungodly. He said, "Woe is me that I dwell in the land, that I dwell in Meshech, that I dwell among the tents of Kedar." If anyone who has ever walked this earth had reason to be grieved that he lived among the ungodly, it was Jesus. Can you imagine how many times this same thought from verse 5 must have crossed the heart and mind of Jesus? Now, no doubt you, and of course I, am sometimes grieved by the ungodliness we see around us. Can you imagine how much more the contrast was for Jesus, who was completely holy, completely pure, completely sinless in every regard? Oh no, living among the ungodly must have been a burden for Jesus that we alone only can imagine, I should say. And not only can we only imagine it, but to think of this love and grace and goodness displayed in Jesus, despite all that, is remarkable. And then finally, let me suggest one third and final way that Psalm 120 may point us to Jesus. It's in the words of verse 7, where the psalmist said, "I am for peace." Now, was there anybody who ever walked this earth who was more for peace, more for God's shalom than Jesus himself? But Jesus was more than for peace. Jesus made peace by the blood of his cross. I love what the New Testament says. He is our peace, and he has broken down every wall. Oh yes, it's true that Jesus was for peace, God shalom, of course. But he was much more than that. He is our peace, and has broken down every wall.